We go back into the archives today to hear one of our favorite interviews from the past. This one is about the power young people feel on stage and a particular teacher who learned how to unleash that power, inspiring generations of students. The year was 2013. The guest, Michael Sokolov. We've all had teachers whose lessons burned themselves into our memories. We'll spend the balance of the hour talking about just such a teacher with a man who was once one of his students. The teacher is Lou Volpe. He teaches theater skills at a high school in Levittown, Pennsylvania. And oh, how he teaches those skills. He gets things out of his students that they often were not aware they possessed. Lou Volpe and his program are profiled in the book Drama High by one-time student Michael Sokolov. Michael Sokolov is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and the author of three previous books, The Ticket Out, Hustle, and Warrior Girls. And he's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange today. Michael Sokolov, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
So you are a Levittown native, Levittown, Pennsylvania. I should point out I'm from Levittown, New York myself. Identical communities, basically.
Absolutely. Well, yes. Levittowns, as you know, were the prototypical post-war mass-produced developments, and they were in their time, you know, just the apotheosis of hope and the American dream.
I'm struck by the fact that even as you go through and list some of the street names in Levittown, Pennsylvania, they are the same street names that exist in Levittown, New York as well. They really were carbon copy stamped onto Pennsylvania. So how different, though, is Levittown, Pennsylvania from what it was like when you were growing up there?
Well, when I was growing up, there was what we all called the mill, and that was U.S. Steel's Fairless Works plant, and it employed 10,000 men, and they were mostly men. There was a GM plant, there was a Thiokol plant, which was a defense contractor. There were all these very high-paying union jobs. And my father was a lawyer, and the only college-educated adult that I knew of beside my teachers in the community. This was, you know, a hardcore blue-collar place. But the men working in these plants, you know, lots of them made more than my lawyer father. That's how good times were. They had second homes in the Pocono Mountains. There were RVs in the driveways. I mean, this was a happening, prosperous place. And it was, you know, part of the engine of post-war America. It was a terrific place in its day.
Happy, prosperous place, all those baby boomer kids running around the streets. But there's quite a rift that you get into in the American dream as it existed in a place like Levittown. And it's got to do with the character of the community. And the fact that because this really was constructed to be a suburb, there wasn't a real sense of center there.
No, there was no downtown. You know, as I described it in the book, there was nothing of visual interest. There was no culture. You know, like a lot of suburban America at that time, there wasn't a lot of attention paid to that. These were big, you know, places to put lots of people into relatively small houses, but it was more room than most of the residents had ever had in their lives. And they came out of the crowded cities, and in my Levittown, they came out of the coal regions of upstate Pennsylvania. So, you know, this was your basic tract housing. And, you know, for me as a kid, I certainly didn't love it. I didn't find it wildly interesting, like lots of Americans who come from towns. I couldn't wait to get out of there and never intended to go back. But it's in me, though. You know, I mean, Levittown is certainly in me. And among other things, it's where I learned to work, you know, like real work. And because that's what it was. It was a working place.
So set the scene for us at Harry S. Truman High School, because it sounds nondescript from every angle. And I guess it went actually by a different name when you went there.
Well, it was named Woodrow Wilson when I went there, and two schools were combined. And the Democratic school board of you know, decided they're going to find the name of another Democratic president, so they gave it the name Harry Truman. But now this community was, you know, culturally poor when I was there, but now it is just impoverished in a different way. All the good jobs are absolutely gone. The plants are closed. This is, you know, this is a big story, not just in Levittown, but across America. This is the epicenter of income inequality. It's in a very wealthy county, but there's like the Grand Canyon between the wealthier part of Bucks County, which is the county outside of Philadelphia where Levittown is, and Levittown. There's a gap. And when I was there, you know, we were not quite at the level of some of these wealthier communities, but there wasn't that enormous gap in opportunity, in income, in sort of social outlook. The people in Levittown now, instead of these great paying union jobs, they work at Walmart, they work at Target, they work in call centers, they work in warehouses, and lots of people, for lots of people, the work ethic remains. So people work, but they work two or three jobs that aren't as good as the one job that they used to have.
In a lot of ways, it has continued to maintain what the American dream currently is, then. In the sense of, like, well, you're going to have to work a lot harder than you once did, and probably at more jobs.
Well, absolutely. It's the new American narrative. I mean, people are really struggling to make it. And the kids who go to college, some of them go to the very inexpensive state colleges in Pennsylvania, cost $12,000 a year, including room and board. They borrow for that, borrow heavily. Those who have a little more going on academically may get to Temple University in Philadelphia, which is a great school. It's not a highly selective school, costs about $25,000 a year. You know, they'll walk out of there with $80,000 in debt by the time they're done. So they're also part of that generation that is just starting out with some deficits.
A couple seconds away from a break here, I just want to establish, though, you did learn from Lou Volpe. He was your teacher at the high school back then. Did you wrestle much about just writing about him?
Well, of course. And I think that I put it off a little bit because I meant going back to my old high school and spending 2 years. You know, that you got to think about that. It meant going back to Levittown. But I felt called home to do this story. I gave the commencement speech several years ago that was out of the blue. I was asked to give that, and I just thought, wow, there's a reason I'm here on this football field, on this sort of hollowed ground, which a football field is at any high school. And it's this beautiful day, and I'm thinking, it's time to write this book.
Michael Sokolow from 2013, talking about his old teacher as told in his book, Drama High. We'll come back to this interview on the Jefferson Exchange in a little more than a minute. Jefferson Exchange on JPR's News and Information Service. I'm Megan Mercier. We're enjoying an interview from 2013 with Michael Sokolow, who wrote about an exceptional teacher and theater program at his old high school in Drama High. Since it's pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails.
This is a story goes back a long way. When did Lou Volpe join the faculty at what became Harry Truman High School in Levittown, Pennsylvania?
He joined the faculty at age 21 in 1969, and he walked into that building where he was to teach English, and he stayed there as a teacher for the next 44 years. So it's quite a career. It's quite a career, and you know, we don't think of people having celebrated careers as a school teacher like we think of, you know, Michael Jordan had a celebrated career as a basketball player or you know, Marlon Brando, whoever you want to think of. But to me, this is a remarkable accomplishment to operate at the level that he operated for all those years.
Well, I have to believe, though, with his success, Lou Volpe would have been in demand, not just at other public schools, but probably at private schools as well, for the way he was able to motivate students and get just amazing things out of them. Why did he stick all those years out at Levittown, Pennsylvania?
I think that he saw this town, he saw himself in this town. He's was a working class kid from a neighborhood in Philadelphia who went to parochial schools, he went to Catholic schools, but these were his people and he felt very loyal to them. And you know, I don't think education is such that somebody's going to offer to double his salary. So I don't know what exactly the inducements would have been, but certainly he could have gone to a more privileged school with more privileged students, more privileged parents, bigger theater, you know, fancier equipment, all that stuff. But I don't really think he ever considered it. This was his home. This is where his ex-wife said to me, this is where his heart beats. And it is where his heart did beat.
There was something particularly pleasing you found about Lou Volpe when you were his student. He appealed to the senses in some ways that you found unusual among teachers. What was that?
I just loved to hear him talk. You know, I just loved to hear him teach. I was a kid who was infused with sports. I was a pretty good student, but what I cared about was the teams I was playing on. And I walked into his classroom in 11th grade, and he was teaching what was then the American canon of literature, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Flannery O'Connor, all these authors. And the way he talked about books and the passion he had for them and the pleasure that you could tell this literature brought him, I sat in that classroom and I thought, this makes him so happy. I just want to read what he reads. And I know that all his students felt that way. I mean, he wasn't a showman in the classroom, but he was so passionate and so versed in the subject that, you know, he just had students who flocked around him and wanted to dedicate themselves. And at that time, even though I was a good student, I don't know that I had great teaching. And one day he said to me, after I had written a paper on Billy Budd, it was very early in my junior year, and Billy Budd is a Melville novella, which I don't think I even understood that well at the time, but I had tried to make some original point. And he applauded my boldness, and he just said to me, you know, you're a very good writer. And somehow I had gotten to that stage of school without anyone pointing that out to me. And it was very powerful. And I've thought about that since, because he says similar things, and it's, you know, he doesn't give people compliments left and right if he doesn't think, you know, they're true. But that is the way any teacher motivates someone. It doesn't have to be that profound, what they say. It just has to be the right thing at the right time and go to a place that no other teacher or no parent has touched. And that's a gift that he and I think many great teachers have.
The timing part in particular seems to be a gift. The way you describe the situation, Michael, it sounds like he just chose the right moment, which, of course, is a good thing to have in a performer, and he was training performers, but he just knew when to flick the switch.
Yes, I mean, he did know exactly when, and I think that as a teacher, he can size up students and see some potential, and he saw some potential in me, and I'm sure he noticed that what he valued about my intellect at that time was something that I was undervaluing. I'm sure he took a look at me and thought, you know, this kid is definitely not going to the NBA. I better give him something else to feel good about. And that's what he did. And I think it's very important, you know, not with me, but with others. His students know that he tells the truth. So, for instance, at a rehearsal, when I came back, you know, years later, over the last few years, when I followed him, at one point I heard him say to a cast, you know, you guys have gotten so good that every mistake you make has a spotlight on it. And I just thought, what a beautiful way to give praise while raising the bar, while making a demand. And look, a teacher, you know, especially with young minds right now, has to be both inspiring and economical. You know, and I think that's one of his great gifts. He knows how to get through very quickly and say what needs to be said.
And there certainly are lots of high schools where the prevailing belief about people involved in theater is that this is something for nerds and sissies and people who need attention, and yet Lou Volpe managed to break through a lot of that. And there was one student in particular who you mentioned over the years, Michael Massari, who really changed Volpe's program forever. What happened there?
Michael Massari was one of the best wrestlers in the state. He was also religious, Christian, and Baptist, I guess, is what he was. And Volpe decided that he was going to do Godspell one year, and Michael Massari just had to be Jesus. And he said, I'm going to do this. And it became a thing between the wrestling coach and Michael and Lou. And Michael was just determined to do this. He said, I can still keep wrestling. I'm in great shape. I'm a vegetarian. I ride my bike. There's this other part of me that I want to express. I want to be on stage. I want to play this part. But mostly I want to be, you know, all that I can be. And this was this is about a quarter century ago. So Michael Massari ended up leaving the wrestling team to be on stage, and that was groundbreaking at this high school. Because after that, long before Glee made a storyline out of the fact that a high school athlete, a male athlete in particular, might go on stage, Mosseri broke that barrier at this high school. And ever since, Volpe was able to call on, you know, students and to get students from every corner of the school. You know, the stereotypical theater kids, but also the athletes, you know, everyone. And it made a huge difference in his program when he did Rent, and we may get into that later, the things that he's done, 300 students at this 1,500-student school, so one in five auditioned for parts. It became almost like a performing arts high school under the radar without a charter for that.
The teacher we're talking about is named Lou Volpe. He is the target, the title character, really, in Drama High, the incredible true story of a brilliant teacher, a struggling town, and the magic of theater. Michael Sokolov actually attended the high school in Pennsylvania at which Lou Volpe taught and also was one of his students, and then came back to write this book years after graduating from what became Harry S. Truman High School in Levittown, Pennsylvania. The big thing, not just about timing that we talked about with Lou Volpe, is it sounds like he really has a way of convincing students to be more than they think they can be.
Absolutely. And of course, theater and the arts do that in general. But, you know, there was a student when I was in the 2 years that I followed this program and the 2 years that really figure into the book. There's one student, Zach Phillippe, all-conference baseball player, possible professional prospect. His father drives a sanitation truck, and Zach becomes interested in theater, stays with baseball, and, you know, he sings on stage, he dances on stage, he is involved in a couple of very, very challenging dramas. And he just said to me, he said, I've got more parts to me than I ever realized that I have. And looking at what Lou did with students who didn't feel that they would ever be attracted to this activity, I just felt like he was giving them a passport into the rest of their souls, that maybe they were going to find, you know, later on in life, or maybe never, if he did not, you know, help lead them there. And I think once someone gets out of their comfort zone, into theater, whatever it is, if you do that at a young age, you know, you're trained. You say, okay, I went up on stage. I did this. I never thought I could do it. You know, later in life, it may not be the theater. It may be something entirely different. But you know, you have that confidence. Yes, I can step outside of my own conception or others' conception of what I should be. I can get out of this little box that people want to put me in.
And this is not a program, we should point out, you mentioned Rent already, and not just doing the standard squishy sorts of, you know, great American musical book sorts of things, because as you start the book, they're working on rehearsals for a play called Good Boys and True, which is very challenging material. What was that about?
Good Boys and True is a drama about a high school, prep school, golden boy athlete, quarterback and captain of his football team, who goes to a shopping mall one day, meets a girl, a public school girl, who's working in the food court, talks to her, picks her up, as we say, arranges to meet her at a house later that night, an empty house where his friend's family is out of town, has sex with her, you know, that night, secretly films it, and then this secretly filmed sex tape, is viewed by his high school teammates, and scandal ensues. You know, he is shamed, the town is, or the school is shamed, his family comes apart. A gay relationship between he and his friend is revealed. So this is the kind of stuff that, number one, actually happens. You know, this has, you know, ultimate believability, but no high school or almost no high school would touch this kind of material. At Harry Truman with Lou Volpe, they did. He said, you know what? we're going to deal with real theater here. We're going to deal with real stuff. High school theater in general is very vanilla. You know, if you taught any other course like high school theater, you know, after school theater goes, it would be like teaching chemistry without DNA. You know, if you look at the plays that are done, these are plays from the 30s and the 40s, let alone the 50s and the 60s. You know, you can't take it with you. The Wizard of Oz, which first existed, you know, in, you know, right 1910 or something. You know, it's crazy, and these are great plays, and they're fun, and they're wonderful, and they should be done, but it's not all that should be done. And Lou basically changes the paradigm. He says, this is not what we do here. We're in Levittown, our kids don't live in perfect little worlds, and they know the world isn't perfect, and their parents know the world isn't perfect. It's not all beautiful. So we're going to put stuff up on stage that helps us work through the world that we actually live in.
Now, he had obviously done the Good Man Charlie Browns and the Bye Bye Birdies and things like that. First of all, what was it in Lou Volpe's background that led him in the direction of theater and literature?
That's a really good question, because the most unlikely part of his career is that he was a theater aficionado. His mother loved theater, took him to the theater, but he had no experience in the theater, not even selling a ticket, not even ushering, until he got to this high school. He went to a very large all-boys Catholic school, and the opportunities to act were not there for him. So he gets to Harry S. Truman, and he applies at one point to be the assistant theater director. The theater director leaves, and he ends up in his, you know, early on as the theater director, and he has no idea what he's doing. And, you know, it's a great testament to what you can teach yourself. And he made friends with other directors and mentors of other directors around the area high schools. He went to Yale during one summer. He went to Northwestern another summer, so he got some very high-end training. And he just learned as he went. He obviously had some underlying, you know, huge skills, you know, a visual acuity, a feel for language, a feel for the emotional pacing of a play. He had all of these things that later were recognized, but they were untrained. He had to learn.
Interesting in the sense that he was able to recognize that there were things in himself he did not know about, sitting there watching the rehearsals of the other drama people and thinking, you know, I'd do this differently. But he didn't really have the skills, as you pointed out, to be able to say that. But he pursued it. He said, I got to go through with this.
Yes. Well, he got out of his own comfort zone. You know, he realized that this was something that he loved. And it is, after all, high school. So he was not being asked to direct on Broadway. So even saying that, the first couple of shows he did, he looks back on and just winces. he did Antigone, and he thought, I'm going to do this very modern. And he, you know, the set was all white, and he put the actors in, you know, tin foil. And, you know, he said, when it was over, no one would even look at him. You know, they just averted their eyes and walked out of the theater. So, you know, that's another thing to learn. In the theater, in any kind of, you know, in anything that's worth it, to tell you the truth, you have to risk humiliation. You have to risk embarrassment. You have to get over it. You have to risk failure. So I think that's a great example for the students who he went on to direct over the years. He didn't start out great at it.
When he made the turn toward edgier fare, you know, communities do have a way of freaking out over school plays, to decisions right down to the, you know, the casting stuff. Oh, my God, they put a freshman in the lead, stuff like that. So so how did he get the buy-in that he would have required from the Harry S. Truman High School community to do the edgier fare as the years went by?
You know, that's a great question, and I've thought about that, because it's very unlikely. Truman High is a place full of the student population. The parents are what used to be called Reagan Democrats. It's a pretty socially conservative community. It's not an early adopting community. But it is a community starved for success. And there's very little of it that has been there over the last 25 years, really. Levittown, Pennsylvania saw its sort of peak a quarter century ago. And it's been all downhill or mostly downhill since then. So Lou was, you know, the football coach, the equivalent of the football coach in the dusty Texas town or the mill town or the company town in Ohio, and an example that and an inspiration that, look, something great can come out of Levittown. Something great can come out of this high school. And I think the more success he had, the more room he was given to experiment with some of this edgier fare. And importantly, and he always said, I'm never going to embarrass the building. So he never put on a play that was sensational just for its sensation. If there was something in that play that was just too much for the high school stage, he would find a way to do it, you know, with its integrity, but to tone it down just enough to still be supported by the school administration and the community.
And it was supported in a big way. We'll return to our 2013 interview with Michael Sokolov about Drama High back on the Jefferson Exchange in a little more than a minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Megan Mercier. Michael Sokolov focused national attention on his old high school in Pennsylvania 3 years ago with a book about the school's phenomenal theater program and teacher. The book is Drama High. The interview is pre-recorded. Here we go.
We've talked about Lou Volpe and his ability to not only know when to say, but not know what to say, but when to say it. The way that the students relate back to him, though, give us some idea of how, particularly in drama rehearsals, that he was able to give his commands, get some give and take with the students, and just interact with them generally. And it sounds like they really kind of lived and died by his praise and criticism.
Well, yes, I think that they did. They certainly wanted to please Lou, and I also think that they felt a tremendous responsibility to the legacy of this program. The actors and actresses and crew that preceded any class, they knew the students who came before them, and they knew the ones who had done the big shows 10 years before, and when those students came back, you know, they were like Broadway stars returning. So there was a legacy, and Lou was certainly a big part of that legacy. You know, in rehearsals and in the classroom, it would seem very informal to anybody listening in. They would walk into Lou's classroom, they'd say, "Hey, Volpe," you know, "Hey, Volpe," and there was a lot of joking that went back and forth. But in a rehearsal, you know, you would never see kids looking at their cell phones. You know, there was just total focus on what they were doing. I think his great gift as a director was not leading his actors and actresses to where they needed to get, but letting them find their way. If someone was on stage and he didn't like the way they were saying a line, he would say, "You know, that's just that's not quite right. Let's try something different." But he wouldn't say the line back, or he might make a joke. He might say, "You know, your shoe was untied. It's distracting. Why don't you tie your shoe and do it again?" And everybody would laugh because they would know it wasn't really about the shoe, of course. In terms of movements on stage, he would just say, "You know what? Move around a little. Let's. You know, you're too still." But he would never walk up on stage and put his hands on somebody's shoulders and say, "Walk from here to here." And I think that's good directing at any level, but it's particularly good directing at a high school level. He knew the answers, or he often knew the answers. With some of his very sophisticated actors, and you know, they could find their own answers, and often answers that Lou didn't have. But he figured, "I got, you know, two and a half months to rehearse this particular show. Let's just let them find their way, and I will very gently, you know, in the background, help lead them." And I just thought that was magical to watch.
And it seems too, there are discussions in the book about situations where he deliberately kept moving students outside their physical comfort zones in a way, you know, not to give them directions and to say, okay, do it differently next time. Well, how? Well, just do it differently. You know, things like that. Really kind of push some buttons in there. And I'm left though with this overall larger question though about the particular challenge of acting for high schoolers and for the people directing them, which is they haven't lived many of the emotions and the situations they portray. So, I mean, how do you, without like putting all the kids on the analysis couch, to get them to dig into stuff in themselves, to pull it out there and put it on stage?
Well, I think that's a great question. And in America these days, I think we think of all high achievement, including for children, coming from certain kinds of communities. Here, I think these working class kids had some advantages when you talk about they hadn't lived these emotions, because they weren't sheltered. They were not kids whose parents could keep, you know, could shield them from failure, could shield them from conflict, could shield them from disappointment. These are kids who came from households where marriages may have blown apart, where they saw, you know, their father's car repossessed in the middle of the night, you know, where they saw some pretty bad stuff. So when they were called on stage, and by the way, the other thing that I think is very smart is Lou always looked for theater and for shows in which his actors could portray people their own age. And there's a lot of that out there. You know, Rent is young people. Spring Awakening is young people. The show Good Boys and True is young people. So it wasn't as far out of their reach as doing some of these old standards that we think of. So they could find these emotions, and they had lives. Look, they had relationships. They had, you know, relationships that mattered to them. They had disappointments. So I think they could find their way to the real emotional core of these parts in a way that, you know, so-called high-achieving students from higher-end zip codes maybe couldn't. And I say that as someone who came from this community and now lives in a very different kind of community. I live in Bethesda, Maryland, where, you know, the levels of education and achievement and income are quite high, and you know, more so than, you know, I still look around where I am sometimes and I said, what am I doing here? So I see the contrast, and I know that the kids from this community would have a much harder time with some of this material than the kids at Truman did.
Their work ethic at Truman High School sounds pretty remarkable, that this is not just like the Glee Club where they go into a Journey song or something. You know, this is these guys are, they're more than having fun. They're really getting into what they're doing.
Well, this is immense work. I mean, I don't think it's unusual for a musical that, you know, these kids rehearse every day. But then on Saturdays, they rehearse from 8 in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon with a lunch break. Now, other high schools do that, but the intensity of focus, if you walk into one of these rehearsals, you would feel that you were not necessarily among high school kids. One of the other theater directors in Pennsylvania, who does very, very good theater himself at his high school, he's now the head of the High School Theater Association in Pennsylvania, so his stuff exists at a very high level, and he said to me at a theater festival, he said, the rest of us do high school theater. Lou Volpe does theater, and I think there was a lot of truth in that.
There's an interesting line in the book where you write that Lou Volpe is not exactly replicable, but a teacher like him is definitely preventable. What do you mean by that?
I think that we have teachers in boxes. You know, we have teachers in very small boxes. This is not a book about education policy or education politics, but you can't read the book without thinking about some of those things. And the message that I didn't hammer anybody over the head with the message. But look, I mean, we have teachers whose salaries, whose futures in education and principals as well, depend on their students' test scores. So the logical, the rational response to that is to teach what is on the test. And not everything in life, and certainly not everything in education, is measurable. And this magic that goes on between teachers and students, and Lou is stand-in for a couple of 100,000 genius teachers. I mean, he's not the only one. But you can't be a genius teacher. You can't be an inspiration if you're put in a straitjacket in your classroom. You know, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, I have a quote from him in the book. You know, he's speaking to his city, and he says, we need these standards so that our teachers can be accountable and responsible. And when you think about it, it makes it sound like he's talking about the children. You know, if we don't have standards, that means our teachers will be irresponsible. And believe me, teachers feel that. So when I say that Lou was not maybe replicable but preventable, I think that, or I fear that part of what we're doing right now in education policy is preventing, you know, just this kind of inspirational teaching.
Given the kinds of pressures that exist on education budgets across the country and the pressure you just noted about keeping up test scores and making sure the grades are all up there and the schools are getting all the income they need, how did Volpe's program manage to stay intact? And I assume it did over all those years he was there.
Well, I think partly because it's not about money. It's, you know, we think things are about money. High school theaters, you know, it's not that expensive an activity. I mean, certainly not compared to football and not compared to lots of other sports. And I say that as someone who's made a lot of my living writing about sports. I'm the last person who's anti-sports. But high school theater, you don't have to travel. You can make your own costumes if you need to. One of Lou's great phrases was, if all we had was a bare stage and a light bulb, we could still do theater. And it's true. You know, so he was able to keep doing what he was doing, partly because it didn't cost that much money. And I think what prevents, you know, robust curriculums and robust arts curriculums in America is not so much money. It's just priorities. And there is plenty of science supporting the benefit of teaching music and art and dance. And people in education know it, but they're not given the incentives right now to do what is really the right thing to do.
There's a real oh yeah moment for the reader of Drama High, Michael Sokolov, and that's when you point out just what you were talking about, where by focusing on arts and some of the education that's more than just math and science and facts and figures and all that stuff, you get to the root of, for example, the appeal of the products put out by the Apple company, because those guys were not exactly great students in math and science.
Well, neither of the leaders of the inventors of the original Mac Steve Jobs did not get through college, let me say. And, you know, one of his great, and the only thing he took in college, by the way, in Oregon at Reed College, I believe, the only thing he really remembered from his short time on campus was a calligraphy course. But he remembered it very well as something that helped, you know, form his exquisite aesthetic taste, which is what Apple is all about. The co-inventor with him was a music student and then a composer and a very accomplished musician. And he didn't see his work at Apple as a departure from his past as a musician. He saw it as an extension. He thought that science and art were, you know, inextricably linked, and they are. And by much of what we're doing in the schools right now, we're breaking that link. I mean, the more we narrow what we give children, the more we narrow, you know, who they're going to be and really narrow who we're going to be as a society.
So the successes of the program, obviously, Lou Volpe got a great reputation in the community. His students loved him. They turned out excellent work. Was anybody able to go on and continue with theater? And some people tried, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because a lot of people have asked that, and it was never exactly the point to me because it wasn't the point to him. But there are a couple of Emmy Award winners in Los Angeles. They're both writers and producers, so they're not huge names. There's a very well-regarded independent film producer who was one of his students. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of people who have acted at various levels, who are still acting in New York, who have become theater teachers themselves, who own little dance academies. You know, so he's not only given this passion for the arts to other people, then they went ahead and became, you know, little mini Lou Volpes. And in fact, his two assistant directors at Truman were his former students. You know, so just, you know, over the generations, he has created you know, artists, people who have made this part of their lives and helped make it part of other people's lives.
Before we run completely out of time, Michael Sokolov, I want to get into one of the side stories. It's one of the stories within the story of Drama High, the Broadway producer coming to Levittown. What was going on there?
Well, in 2001, Cameron McIntosh, Sir Cameron McIntosh, whose people pointed out to me that he should not be described as a multimillionaire. He's a billionaire. So he is the impresario behind, among other shows, Les Miserables. And he wanted this very complicated musical to be sort of put into the bloodstream of high school theater, and he needed somewhere where it could be piloted. So the first place he chose was a high school on Long Island, and they did a very good job of it, but he wasn't pleased enough. So they needed to find another high school, and they found their way to Luvope. They asked them to do it. So McIntosh took a limousine from Manhattan one day, and he drove about an hour and a half south to Levittown. He parked in the principal space, and they made a little buffet for him in the guidance office. And here was the most famous man on Broadway, the most powerful man on Broadway, coming to this high school that everyone else wanted to leave. And the students were very concerned that he, you know, wouldn't be comfortable in the seats in this ancient auditorium, that he'd get splinters in his backside, as one of them said. Well, he loved the show, just loved it. Stayed for the cast party in the cafeteria, was slapping everybody in the back and saying, "Brilliant, brilliant!" And that was the moment that Les Mis was given the okay, and the rewritten version of Les Mis for high schools is the Lou Volpe and Truman version of Les Mis.
Michael Sokolov from 2013 talking about his inspiring book, Drama High.